From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with director Anthony Minghella about adapting the Booker Prize-winning novel The English Patient to the screen. It wasn't until he began working on the project that he realized how hard it would be to capture the spirit of the book on film. Minghella made his directorial debut with the acclaimed Truly, Madly, Deeply. Also, Canadian short fiction writer Alice Munro talks about her experience combining writing with parenting and the small towns of Ontario where she grew up. She has a new collection of short stories. And TV critic Dava Bianculli reflects on election coverage. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
But I'm in the 87 years and I record a film for the knee, but slimmer could be serves a wicked sketch that's more from the crazy. And if my kids naked, do a song in the Shannonburg City Laugh, who see old McAlbin, your firm is Earl, so sharing his eater, her voice is Larry. Here I am, you know, in the mats and the McAdder, so just there the wing is sexed, bait, none of them, but the way, the bed, there's Neddy, and really, Svetic, as a goose, the nips, the seat of these, see me lost, there's Neddy, pretty boys.
Oh, we're all asking the evening, Mr. Ernest, and he went. This, yes, then that's the old me, that soon you was knack of this, and the wind of my cave old me, and the old me, that such near rusty.
Spitty has a foxy to mix a fill of rest, sad names, grammars to see a reveal, go up, there's a laugh, as a wicked sketch, but a mercy. Sorry, your wolf's kind of the finale, say he's still west, no one here, and I should learn as near as to the veil, as the gifts go slow, or sir, mach, and I should not sniff, as the serious percussive. Maj, to the murph and the shame, gives her six line, oh, to the hill, oh, shite out with it, the gifts gives her for two, no way, to the serious percussive. And then walk the broke mountain, and you shall, and soon you know, either the luck will shine.
Fresh Air support comes from Morrow, publishers of the new autobiography, Joycelyn Elders, M.D., From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Michael Ondaatje's best-selling novel, The English Patient, is now a film. It stars Ralph Fiennes, Kristin Scott Thomas, Juliette Binoche, and Willem Dafoe, and opens next week in New York and Los Angeles. My guest, Anthony Minghella, wrote and directed the movie. The story intercuts between two love affairs, during and before World War II, in an abandoned villa in Italy and in the deserts of North Africa. Fiennes plays the English patient, a man burned beyond recognition when his plane crashes in the desert. In flashbacks, we learn about his life as an explorer in the Sahara and his love affair with Catherine, his colleague's wife, played by Scott Thomas. In this scene, they're trying to watch a movie, but their thoughts are elsewhere.
I better go now. Say goodbye here.
I'm not agreeing. Don't think I'm agreeing, because I'm not.
Any minute now, he'll find out. We'll barge into someone. It will kill him.
Don't go over it again, please. Catherine. I just want you to know I'm not missing you yet.
You will. You will.
The other lovers in the film are Hannah, an army nurse, who's caring for the English patient at the end of the war, and Kip, an Indian soldier in the British Army. Minghella collaborated on the screenplay with the book's author, Michael Ondaatje, and his producer, Saul Zantz, but I asked him if he still wasn't just a little bit afraid that his film would fall short of the novel.
Well, I think that you know, of course I felt an enormous trepidation, because what's distinctive about this project is that I love Michael Ondaatje's writing. I'd read everything he'd ever written. Reading The English Patient was supposed to be a treat, not an invitation to do a job. And if nothing else, and if no one else, I wanted one person to be happy with this film, and that was Michael himself. So obviously, I approached the whole project with some caution. He can write Crown, and what you do as a reader is you fashion a king, you know, and or he can write Castle, and you fashion a kingdom. Whereas one of the things which is, you know, disappointing, I suppose, about filmmaking is it's incredibly prosaic, and certainly in its first stages, is that there's an obligation to fill the camera with something. You can't just simply, if you point a camera at a crown, you see a crown and nothing else. And so in a book which does have such enormous ambitions in terms of the countries and times that it traverses, one of the things I had to do as the adapter of the book was to go and teach myself the history and geography that the book maps. And so I found myself, you know, submerged in the literature of the 30s, in the memorabilia and memoirs of the 30s, and letters and diaries and cuttings. And so what happened was, when I came to go back to the novel, I came armed with so much of my own compulsions about the time and the place and the circumstances of Cairo or of Italy at the end of the war, that I found myself with a huge deluge of material to bring to bear, because I had to fill in rather than do this you know, suggestive art that Michael can indulge in.
Well, you shut yourself up in a cottage in Dorset in mm-hmm. England with all of these books of history and geography, but you say you didn't take the actual novel, The English Patient, with you. Why not?
Well, it's probably evident from what I've said so far that this is a novel that meant a great deal to me, that spoke to me, I think, there for all kinds of reasons. You know, that there are certain intrinsic kindred relationships between Michael and I which speak in this book. And I suppose that, you know, frankly, what I was nervous of was that if I took the book with me, I'd sit all day copying out chunks of it into the screenplay. And the one thing, of course, that I think would have been a terrible error in this movie would have been to have made some kind of literary artifice which knelt down and paid homage to the book, which didn't exist in its own right as a film.
You know, film really isn't very good at subtleties, but this is a film full of subtleties. For instance, the English patient can barely move. Ray Fiennes has so much makeup on his face as a burn victim that mm-hmm. his movements are so spare, and everyone tells.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, what we did, poor Rafe, you know, we had a body cast. It's not makeup, but he had a body cast made by the Jim Henson Creature Shop, and they literally made him a skin. And he had a skin for every day that he was the English patient at Cinecittà in Rome, and he had to be, you know, fitted inside this skin every morning. And it was an extraordinary thing. He disappeared, in a way, into that skin and disappeared, became somebody else. And well, the only thing he had available to him really was his voice and his eyes. And even his eyes, which are, you know, notoriously piercing and haunting, they were obscured by very dark contact lenses and very blurred contact lenses. And so he made it as hard as it could possibly be, or I made it as hard as it possibly could be, for you to understand or relate to him. And yet, nevertheless, what it does is it simplifies the instrument, as it were, so much that every note becomes extremely significant and sharp.
There's really a lovely scene in the movie between the pair of lovers, Hannah, the nurse, mm-hmm. and Kip, the Sikh disposal, bomb disposal expert. Kip arranges a surprise for Hannah. He takes mm-hmm. her to a chapel. It's dark. He hoists her up on a pulley and puts a burning flare in her hand. And she swings up and down as the flare illuminates beautiful frescoes on the walls of the chapel. And it has such a gentle, romantic tone. And that tone comes up so much throughout a movie that's about shell-shocked people in war, about death, about loss.
Well, you know, here's what I thought, which was that I wanted to make an extremely erotic film. It seemed to me that given that the central notion to me in the book, or the line that most resonated with me, was that the heart is an organ of fire. And I thought, then I wanted to in a way, characterize an incandescent, slightly catastrophic, raging love story in which people, in a sense, become perhaps less civilized, but certainly more human. They rage at the love that they feel. And I'm talking about now Catherine Clifton and Amishi, the other couple in the film. And that, because of that, because I wanted that to be a no-holds-barred physical relationship, it seemed to me that given that there was another very important love story in the film, that had to have its own music and its own particular characteristics. And I thought, well, how could I make a love scene in a film in which people didn't even touch each other? How could I do something in which the lovemaking was done in the form of some gift? And so here's an example, really, of the blessing, I suppose, of not having the book too close to me when I was writing, was that there was a moment of Kip in the novel taking an old university professor to look at some frescoes. And I was so touched by that in the book. But obviously, as I talked about earlier, I was trying to find some dramatic correlative of those ideas in the novel. And thinking of that and remembering that gave me the opportunity to give Kip and Hannah their love scene in this, I suppose, quite distinctive and very tender fashion, because I wanted the tenderness of love and the healing issues of love to be running in the film alongside, as you said, the more coruscating landscapes of the film.
You filmed many of the scenes in the deserts of the Sahara mm-hmm. and in Tunisia. And I would imagine filming in the desert poses some practical problems. I mean, I can't imagine the cameras go very well with blowing sand. What mm-hmm. unforeseen difficulties did you encounter filming on location?
Well, I think the first thing, you know, I said earlier that stupidity has informed almost every junction of this job for me. And I think that when I went to scout the desert, I was so, as many people before me, so overwhelmed by its clarity and by its sort of spiritual nourishing and simplicity, that I quite overlooked what was going to be involved when I had a film camera there and a film crew and 150 people needing to do their work. And the first thing I want to say about it is that the desert, filming in the desert, is like filming in snow. It's completely unforgiving, just in a very prosaic sense, which is that you can't walk over a dune and then try and photograph it because you leave your footprints behind. And so we had this gymnastic stricture of how to get to the places we wanted to shoot without leaving our footprints, how to get the cameras to places which didn't have roads. The sensation I had was of being a calligrapher in many ways. I had a brush loaded with paint and a virgin sheet of paper, and the minute that I made a mark, that was it. It was irreducible and unerasable, and I had to stay with it and commit myself. And that put such pressure on me that I'm afraid that whereas when I went initially, I thought the desert was the most beautiful place in the world, I ended up thinking it was the most unforgiving, and it was my enemy, and I was its enemy, and it was extremely difficult for me. And I made matters as bad as I could by breaking my ankle about 2 weeks before we got there.
And you didn't even take an afternoon off, apparently.
Well, like Count Olmushi in the film, Ralph Fiennes' character, who is compulsive and obsessed, and I found myself compulsive and obsessed about making this film. I felt as though somehow everything was depending on my pulling this film off, that it was me, that I lost all sense of, I think, a perspective when I was doing it. I became this maniac for finishing this film and coming out of my own desert and finishing it.
Anthony Minghella is my guest. He's the screenwriter and director of the new film, The English Patient, based on the Michael Ondaatje novel. We're going to take a short break now, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Anthony Minghella. He wrote the screenplay and directed the new film, The English Patient. Your parents are from Italy, and apparently in the course of your research for The English Patient, you happened on some information about a tragedy that occurred in your father's hometown during the war. You hadn't heard the story from your father?
Well, it wasn't so much that I didn't know about the fact that the monastery in Monte Cassino was razed to the ground by the Allies. It was that I didn't know the circumstances, and I think that one of the things that struck me when I was doing the research was that I was probably in many ways trying to find my way back to Italy, which is my parents' home, and I found out all kinds of things. I found out that how long the war was becalmed in Monte Cassino, how many people died, and what varying nationalities of people died. There were Brazilian deaths, there were Polish deaths, there were Indian deaths. I think one of the things that happens is that there's a certain simplification of our understanding of history. And one of the things that happens when you do the research is you realize that wars are chaotic and don't fall into easy and comfortable patterns. And I also discovered that a member of my family was involved in leading a partisan movement in Tuscany, which I hadn't known about before. In fact, my father didn't know about. So there were many discoveries I made, and not least I managed to get back to Italy to make a film. And it's obviously, in terms of my own sensibility as a maker of fiction, as a director, Italy is my home in every sense.
How did your parents end up in England?
My mother spent all her life in England. Her parents had come from a tiny village near to where my father comes from. My father came to England because he was a shepherd in Italy, and it was of very humble stock, and a paisan, we say. And one of the, I think, the very familiar features of all issues of emigration has been that when people come to another country and are successful, they tend to bring poor relations and friends with them to be drudges in a way. And I think that what happened with my father was that somebody sent him a railway ticket to bring him to England so that he could work for an ice cream company. And in fact, he did that, started that 50 years ago, and he's still an ice cream man today. It's interesting you should mention that, because one of the things that's happened to me, I realize, is that when I was in Rome and Cinecittà and so excited to be shooting there and in Fellini's footsteps, I was reading Fellini's biography, and in his biography he was talking about his own father, who was a seller of prosciutto and salami and olive oil, and he was saying that, you know, when he was a kid, his dad would be talking about this stuff, and he was privately vowing to himself he would never ever sell anything himself, and then he found himself in his adult life sitting in front of Hollywood producers selling them his particular brand of prosciutto and salami. And my dad, you know, encouraged me, I use that word advisedly, to drive an ice cream van for him when I was a kid and sell ice cream, and I would always vow to myself that at no point in my life would I ever sell anybody anything. And then of course now I find myself with my particular brand of ice cream to sell here.
Now, you also grew up on the Isle of Wight, and mm-hmm. I don't know much about the Isle of Wight. I think of it as a desolate place. Is that what it's like?
No, it's not desolate at all, but I must tell you that it's funny because Michael and Saul plagued me because I was determined to get as many references to the island as I could into the film. And it's a great irony, and I think one that I celebrate, that irony in the film, is that it's a film that keeps saying, look, let's look at the way we make boundaries. Let's look at this artifice of nationality, this sort of strangely plaguing issue of patriotism. Look how stupid it is. Look how damaging it is. And at the same time, I keep colliding with the fact that I'm, in many ways, incredibly nationalistic, and I'm extremely nostalgic about the Isle of Wight. I want to keep colliding with it. I want to, if you said to me, I come from the Isle of Wight, then you'd be my friend for life. And that's one of the ironies, I think, of the way that we are. The island itself is a very, very beautiful and very neglected place off the coast of southern coast of England. And I spent the first 18 years of my life there, and it was although it was a cultural backwater, I mean, that's what's desolate about it, is that there aren't too many books there. It's also an extraordinary place, a beautiful place, and I was very happy to spend time there.
I'd like to talk about your first film, Truly, Madly, Deeply. And that was a little bit of a sleeper, if I can say so, in the United States. And I think it was a real shame. I have to say, this movie, I can't describe it very well, but just briefly, it was about a woman whose lover had died, and she just can't let him go. She can't get over it. And then one day, her lover is there. He's there in their apartment where they live together, only he's from the world of the dead. He's a ghost, somewhat. And by the way, Alan Rickman is great at being dead in this movie. He comes back to their relationship, though, with a lot of annoying baggage as a result of being dead. Now, this is a comedy, and after I finished watching it, I thought, I don't really know what that was all about, but it was a lot of fun. How did other audiences respond to it? You must have gotten some strange responses.
Well, it's very interesting to me that 5 years after I made that film, I'm still getting letters, and I'm still encountering people who for whom that film meant something. And in fact, the British Association of Psychotherapy used the film now as bereavement counseling. And I think that what it was about for me was very simple. Maybe that was too simple, you know, was that often you have to move on, and one of the ways that you move on from loss is to see what it really was. You know, there's a certain amount of nostalgia that goes on about relationships which are over, not only people who've died, but things that we've given up or moved away from. And what the film said was, instead of dealing with that in an intellectual way, why don't I dramatize what it means to have the thing you most want come back to you, the thing you think you can't do without come back to you. And it's an allegorical film, obviously, because what Alan Rickman's character does in it is say, look at me for what I really was and not for what you wanted me to be, and in some ways exaggerate some of those more irritating and aggravating qualities in order to free her to move on. And you realize he's been a ghost with a mission in the film.
I don't want to read too much into your movie, so stop me here if this is an example of that. But looking at Truly, Madly, Deeply and The English Patient, there are so many parallels. They're both in some sense about loss. In the first case, in Truly, Madly, Deeply, the character gets back something that she lost, and it helps her, but it's not really what she wanted. Or I guess one of the messages is, beware of what you wish for. Mm-hmm. And The English Patient is loss on every possible level. I wonder how, after making two movies with such parallels, how you personally come out on the other side of that.
Well, first of all, I think that both of, I think what these two films have in common is that the central characters are haunted in some way by what's happened to them, and they both are able to bring these ghosts somehow to life. The ghost of Catherine Clifton for The English Patient is the ghost he has to exorcise in order peculiarly not to move on but to let go. He has to die, and in many ways, I think he's a man trapped in life until such time as he can work out the relationship that he had with somebody in the past. And I tried to make a film in which the past was in many ways more urgent than the present. Where I come out of all of this is that I suppose inevitably I want films which have an emotional register. You know, I want to make stories in which people are encouraged to feel as much as they're encouraged to think. I think that's an underused muscle. I think there's a difference between feeling and reacting. You know, I think that there's a type of movie which is being made at the moment which appears to be about emotion is in fact a sort of theme park ride. It throws you back in your seat and rocks you around. I think the emotion that asks you to make a contribution as a member of an audience, which takes an audience seriously, is something which those films are not being made so much anymore. And I suppose that when you talk about what the films are about, I'm an academic who loses all sense of his brain when he's working. I think, you know, I don't write from my head. I know I write from my heart and make films from my heart. And I suppose that it's no accident those two films which have been so important to me have been films in which there is a sort of intellectual structure, but essentially they're about trying to give people access to a full range of emotion.
And you personally, how does it resonate in your life?
Well, one of the virtues of being a dramatist is that you are forced into a position which takes you away from any overt investigation of your own pathology, I think. I mean, the nice thing is that you dramatize debate and you dramatize differences of opinion rather than simply shedding light on your own personality. And in many ways, I'm completely uninterested in myself and my own position. And one of the thrills about making drama is that it deals with argument and it deals with the moral complexity of position. I think what it says is that there are some fictions which seem to look at the world from a great height and tell you how the world works. The sort of fiction that I'm interested in says, look how complicated the world is. I don't understand it. I, Anthony Minghella, don't understand the way that we hurt each other, heal each other, support each other, lie to each other, are truthful to each other. I don't understand it. You know, come and share that with me.
Anthony Minghella, I really enjoy talking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anthony Minghella's film, The English Patient, opens next week in New York and Los Angeles, and in theaters around the country at the end of the month. This is Fresh Air. Coming up, why one critic calls writer Alice Munro's short stories gossip informed by genius. Munro has won Canada's most coveted literary award 3 times. She has a new collection of short stories. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us what he thought of election coverage. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Canadian short story writer Alice Munro is sometimes referred to as North America's Chekhov. She's celebrated for her ability to evoke the spirit of a place, most often the small towns of southwestern Ontario where she grew up and still lives today. Many of her readers simply refer to that region as Alice Munro country. One critic describes her stories as telling portraits of ordinary people living simple lives in a complex way. Munro is the author of one novel and seven previous collections of short fiction, including The Beggar Maid, Friend of My Youth, and Open Secrets. Her new collection, Selected Stories, draws on the work of her entire career. I asked Alice Munro whether she had always felt such a clear affinity for the landscape and the rhythms of her hometown.
From as long as I can remember, I was very affected by the landscape, and maybe less by the town until I grew up and went away. And then remembering things. I used to try to hold everything in my mind. There was a great need for accuracy about it somehow, so that I could see things exactly as they were. And I wouldn't quite call this, it's not so simple as affection. It's just some reality that you recognize as the basic reality for you. And to me, it's that town. I was back there just, you know, I live about 20 miles away. And we were back in Wingham just a few days ago. And I was walking up and down the streets and looking at it and thinking, it's really odd how this place absolutely captured my imagination. Because it's sort of just a typical small town. And yet to me, it was completely unique. And the towns I make in my mind when I'm writing have that quality of enormous importance that towns used to have to people who lived in them, because people didn't go out of town very much. They didn't drive out to work as they do now, and life was lived so completely in that setting that I think probably everything was more meaningful to the people who lived in town, say, in the early 50s than it is now.
Now, your father was a fox farmer at
That's
one
right.
time. I'm not
That's
sure.
Right.
I'm not sure I know what that is.
Well, it does sound a bit strange, but what he did really was raise foxes, silver foxes, which are a mutation of red foxes. Women wore silver fox capes, and I don't know if you've ever seen one or not. They started to show up in secondhand clothing stores in the 70s, and they generally look pretty ratty. And later on, about 1940, he started to raise mink as well. And you know about mink. People are still wearing mink.
Was there much money in your house? Did he do well?
Oh, are you kidding? No, it was one of those things at which you can do very well if you get in at the right time and with enough backing. But of course, we didn't. And we kept afloat until after the Second World War, and then things began to go. The market simply disappeared, and this wasn't, naturally enough, it wasn't a subsidized thing like dairy farming, and so nobody really cared if you disappeared. It was a chance you'd taken. So in the late 40s, we had practically no cash flow at all.
Sometimes when things are hard in a family, some kids escape by reading. Were you one of those kids?
I started reading long before there was any need for escape. And also, I must say that even though things were hard, I grew up in a part of the country where things were hard for a lot of people. And so I didn't feel particularly that this was a problem. It wasn't until I got away from home that I realized how difficult it had been for my parents and how much fewer things I could ask for as I was growing up than many of the girls I was in college with and could expect out of life. But I started reading, really, I wouldn't even call it an escape. It was like a heightening. It was a heightening of my real life. And it soon became, by the time I was maybe 9 or 10, tremendously important, and I was the person that I am today who cannot imagine life without this extra dimension of the books that you're reading.
Your parents wanted you to learn to sew and knit.
Yes.
And do housework. But you say you knew you wanted to be a writer since you were 9 or 10.
Yes.
Where did you get the idea? Straight from the books?
Well, I was reading all these books, and I think one day I thought, I didn't want to leave the stories behind. And the way that they wouldn't be shut up in a book and left behind was that I would make up one of my own, and then I would always have it in my head. And so I began to make up stories that were actually very like whatever I happened to be enthralled with in reading at the moment. And so I would always, this wasn't writing anything down, but this was, I remember doing it when I was in about grade 7, having a historical novel that was patterned on some stuff I'd been reading. And then I can remember, all sorts of things that I was writing in my head in high school. And then I think when I got to be about 15, I started trying to write some of them down, and it was a dreadful disappointment how hard it was and how nothing really came out on the page the way I wanted it to.
Well, you went to college. You got married right out of college.
That's right. I didn't graduate. I had a 2-year scholarship. And as I said, there was no money to go further. So after 2 years, I got married. I was 20.
How much did you write when your children were young?
You'd be surprised how much I managed. I'm surprised now when I think about it. I tried something almost every day. My children took naps. Naps were very important in our family. And then after a while, they went to school. And I would try, but I had to tear up most of the things I wrote. And this wasn't really a matter of being a housewife and a mother of small children and not having enough time. It was simply a matter of learning my craft, which took me a long time.
I'm thinking of a quote from one of the characters in your stories that spoke to me as a parent. In my own house, you write, I seem to be often looking for a place to hide, sometimes from the children, but more often from the jobs to be done and the phone ringing and the sociability of the neighborhood. I wanted to hide so that I could get busy at my real work, which was a sort of wooing of distant parts of myself. What form did that wooing of distant parts of yourself take?
You know what it is? It's just sitting and looking at the wall or looking out the window, usually with a cup of coffee going cold beside me. And it's not really trance-like or anything like meditation. My word for it to the children and my husband is just, I'm thinking. But I'm not really thinking in a logical way. I am just trying to get some feeling, picture, necessity to come straight in my head. And that is one of the hardest things to do because you look like you're not doing anything.
That's exactly right. And guilt and parenting, they go together. But and I hope you don't take this wrong. I would think that if you were, say, a scientist who went off from the family to discover the cure for cancer, that's one thing. But writing seems to induce so much guilt. It's so literally self-centered.
Because it's literally self-centered. It also may come to nothing. It's not like a job you have. And it's very hard to justify. But I think it's particularly hard to justify for women. I know lots of male writers who at the same stage that I was at would have actually a room in the house where they went and did this business. And everybody would sort of make sure that Dad wasn't disturbed. But generally, there was a wife who was holding the fort. For women, there isn't any setup like this. And there also isn't in women of my generation. There tends not to be the feeling that this is what you deserve. I still find it hard to think that I deserve that time.
To this day?
To this day. I can be made to feel guilty if a friend phones just to chat, and I screen my calls and I don't answer the phone and decide to call her back later, I will feel guilty. I'll feel guilty. And also just about all the things that I could be doing to be a better homemaker as I was trained to be. And I'm not. For instance, there are weeds in my flower bed. I'm thinking about that. That is on the edge of my consciousness all the time as I write. But I must say, I've managed so that this isn't a big problem. People get used to guilt, you know. You live with it.
One critic referred to your writing as gossip informed by genius.
I know.
Well, I can understand you enjoying the genius part of that.
I enjoy the gossip part, too.
Well, what about the gossip? Do you like that description of your writing? What is that
yes,
word?
Yes, I think I do, because, of course, it's redeemed by the genius. If it had been called gossip, I might have been rather huffy. But gossip, there's a pretty wide interpretation for gossip, isn't there? There can be very malicious gossip, which is actually spreading rotten and perhaps untrue stories about people. And there can be gossip, and I think women have done this always, in which you get together and you simply try to figure out life. You talk about your sister-in-law's divorce or somebody's problems with their mother-in-law or something, but it's trying to analyze what people are like, what people say and what they think, which may be different things, and gathering in all the evidence you have for this. You listen to women on the train or on the bus. And when I say that women gossip, I'm not using it as a pejorative thing at all. I think this is something we've always done. We try to make sense of the world around us or to record it, and generally in terms of human relationships.
Are you the kind of person who always knows what's going on in your town?
Yes. And when I was a young wife and mother and I had friends who were in the same situation, we would get together maybe about once a week, and we'd drink endless cups of coffee and smoke endless cigarettes, because you did in those days, and just tell the truth about everything. I suppose it could be called gossip, but mostly it was hilarious. And I think, we laughed all the time, even though what we were talking about was probably disappointment and frustration things that didn't make us particularly happy. But we were together, and we were sharing all this stuff. And we were enormously helpful to each other, I think.
Alice Munro is my guest. She's one of Canada's leading fiction writers. Her short stories appear in The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, and The Paris Review. Her latest collection, Selected Stories, draws from her work of the past two decades. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Canadian writer Alice Munro. Many of her short stories are about women who are unhappy in love. One of Munro's characters says that some women like herself might be always on the lookout for an insanity that could contain them. For what was living with a man if it wasn't living inside his insanity? I suggested that was a certain kind of romance many women seek out as a rebellion against a Victorian and sexually repressed upbringing.
I think there was probably a time when the only escape from some very confining life, and there's still maybe something in this, and not just for women, for men too, is a wild and probably doomed love affair. And that was partly what I meant in the passage you read, but I also meant it seems that in long-term relationships, often the woman's way of accommodating is to live inside. What I think further along in the paragraph I say, you know, the insanity could be something quite ordinary, like his fanatical devotion to a baseball team or something like that. But she has got to get inside it make it hers as well. She moves from a position of being able to look at this objectively to having given herself up in a way.
It's a survival skill women learn to submerge.
Well, it's not just that. I think some women want to do it too, because that's partly what I was writing about. I was writing about this rather ordinary survival skill, but then also the other thing where the character in that story, I think, says to herself that she's got to find a really good insanity. I mean, just an ordinary one won't work for her. She has got to find a man who is extremely forceful, self-sufficient, and who lives in the world on his own terms. And if she wants to be with him, she will have to live on those terms. So I think it's an attraction as well as a survival thing.
You've written series of short stories that share the same characters, and a reader can trace a character's development through the stories. Why didn't you make those stories into a novel? Or what's the difference for you between writing these short fiction and a novel?
You know, I really don't know. I used to try to write novels. Because, you know, when I started out writing, what you did was write a few short stories until you sort of got on your feet, and then you wrote a novel. And that's what I thought I should do, and it was also what publishers thought I should do. And I tried and tried and tried, and something always went wrong. I got bored with the novel. Things got flabby. And I didn't feel the right tension. I feel very tense about short stories, just as if you're on a tightrope or if there's a rope pulling you somewhere. And I didn't get that feeling when I tried to write novels. I did write Lives of Girls and Women, which is a very episodic sort of novel, and it's the usual thing about, you know, growing up, childhood, and adolescence. And I could only do that after I got it chopped into very distinct segments and could do it that way. So it was almost like working at a series of stories. And this may have something to do with the fact that when I was a young mother, I couldn't possibly take a year out of my life to write a novel. I could take a month to write a story and then, you know, catch up on all the things I'd let go. But it got to be my habit, and it got to be the only way I can now write fiction. And yet the stories are very untidy stories. They tend to have a lot of, different pathways. And I find myself shaping them in ways that are rather strange. So what I'm doing now, I guess, is writing ever longer stories.
Do you ever fear that at the end of your career, you'll have all of these stories, but it will feel to you as if they're bits and pieces of things?
You know, that's what Catherine Mansfield said. She said how awful it would be to die. Of course, she died when she was 32, I think, and she said how terrible to leave all these bits and pieces. And I used to think of that quite a bit, but I don't now, because stories I've found can have a longer life than novels. If they're picked up for anthologies, they keep alive, and then a book of stories may be reissued just as easily as a novel. And that doesn't worry me at all anymore. I think of each story as the main, while I'm doing it, it's the main work of my life. And I can hardly remember what I used to write before I started doing it. And then when I'm finished with it, it goes out there and joins all these other offspring, and I hardly think of it again. So I guess I don't think in terms of what I'm going to leave behind or what my reputation is. I'm always just thinking of the work I'm doing right now.
I'm thinking of one of the characters in your story, Material. She reads a short story by her ex-husband, who she never thought would turn out to be a decent writer.
And that's right.
And the story affects her very deeply, and she's envious that he can, I think in the character's words, turn a lifetime of memories into art, while for her they're just useless baggage. Now, I imagine this is bitterness talking, that this character...
Yes, I think it's bitterness, because I think it's because of her particular experience with that man that she feels this way. I don't for one minute think that people envy me for turning a lifetime of experience into art or into stories. Because I think that's what I was talking about before, that's what the women on the bus are doing. That's what women in kitchens are doing. And I think men do it too. My husband is a World War II veteran, and I know when I listen to his friends that I feel that they are creating life stories.
You called your stories entertainments at one
yes.
point. Is that exactly what you mean? That they come lightly?
I want them to be entertaining. Nothing bothers me worse than being written about as a bleak or grim writer, and it happens. And I don't intend this, because I can be entertained by a very serious story. Anything that surprises me, that makes me see anything differently, anything that gives me a gift, is entertaining. It lightens my spirits. It makes me happier. That's what I think art does for people. And I think what is thought of as serious art can do this perhaps more readily than art which sets out to be frivolous.
Alice Munro, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you.
Alice Munro's new book is Selected Stories. And that's Don Byron's version of Bounce of the Sugar Plum Fairies. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews this year's election coverage. This is Fresh Air. Four years ago, when Bill Clinton was elected president for the first time, it was widely assumed that the means by which he had campaigned on TV, playing saxophone in Arsenio, confronting personal questions on 60 Minutes, settling the boxers or briefs issue on MTV, would change politics forever. 4 years later, with another presidential campaign come and gone, TV critic David Bianculli has a different opinion.
I admit it. I was one of the people who thought the election of 1992 was a genuine TV revolution. You know, politicians going straight to the people and all that. In 92, Larry King didn't just interview candidates on CNN. In the case of Ross Perot, he helped create one. So in 96, who knew how far TV and politicians would go? Well, now we know. And the answer is, not very far. Perot, a strong third-party presence in much of 92, couldn't even talk his way onto the presidential debates in 96. Larry King made virtually no news this time around, and the candidates didn't go too far afield to attract voters. Had Phil Donahue still been around, things might have been different. But he wasn't, so they weren't. In 1992, Clinton had nothing to lose, so popping up all over TV was a smart thing for him to do. In 96, Clinton the president didn't have to stoop so low, and Bob Dole the veteran politician didn't want to. The lesson to learn here, probably, is that each election is so different that no hard and fast rules apply, for the candidates or for television. On election night this year, the trick for the networks was how to report what they knew without saying too much while polls were still open. CBS All Night was the most aggressive here. And if you listened closely to Dan Rather when he opened his CBS evening newscast at 6:30 Eastern Time, it wasn't that hard to read between the lines.
CBS News has been interviewing voters as they left the polls today. We are not reporting results in any state where the majority of the polls are still open. We can tell you this. Voters are telling us that they are generally satisfied with the state of the country and the economy. And in the past, this has boded well for incumbent presidents.
One thing CBS did more than any other network was announce election projections the very second polls closed in certain states. Despite all the high-glitz sets and fancy database retrieval systems, what counts is news, and what counts most with news is speed and accuracy. On those two counts, CBS did the best job. Other observations about election night. Those silly cyber sets made Harry Smith of CBS and Lynn Scher of ABC look like they were walking around on the holodeck from Star Trek The Next Generation. And both Dan Rather at CBS and Peter Jennings at ABC got all excited showing how they could touch their computer screens and call up voting results. But viewers don't care at all how the information gets on the screen. If it makes for a smoother flow of information, fine. But just do it. Don't waste time telling us how. Finally, there are those infamous late-night remarks by David Brinkley, who swore once while thinking he was off camera and insulted Clinton while knowing he was on camera. Among other things, Brinkley said Clinton was a bore and that he didn't have a creative bone in his body. Brinkley is retiring Sunday after hosting his last edition of This Week with David Brinkley. So I don't know whether those startlingly candid remarks were a slip from an elderly newsman who was up a little too late, or a wicked what-the-hell exit speech, like the one Howard Beale gave in the movie Network. I do know this, though. This Sunday, This Week with David Brinkley is likely to have the biggest audience in its history, just to see what Brinkley will say next and last.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Morrow, publishers of the new autobiography, Joycelyn Elders, M.D., From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.